The Snake River has cut the Seven Devils Canyon more than 3,000 feet deep without reaching the bottom of the lavas. This enormous area, embracing all the northern states between the Rocky Mountains and the Pacific Coast, was flooded with molten rock and metal pouring out of fissures torn in the ground. Certainly it does not look like a volcanic eruption of our days, and for this reason alone, if not for a multitude of others, the principle of uniformity is definitely misleading. The depth of the lava of this vast Columbia Plateau is as great as 5,000 feet or more. Even on the supposition that it was ejected in paroxysms, each time spreading a sheet only 75 feet thick, it is still enormous, and then such an ejection must have been repeated as much as 70 times in the Cenozoic age, the age of mammals and man. And here is a striking thing, striking because we are too readily disposed to consider that we have solved a problem when we remove it to the remote past. All competent observers have remarked the freshness of lava deposits in the Snake River Valley in Idaho. Only a few thousand years ago lava flowed there over an area larger than France, Switzerland, and Belgium combined. It flowed not as a creek, not as a river, not even as an overflowing stream, but as a flood, deluging horizon alter horizon, filling all the valleys, devouring all the forests and habitations, steaming large lakes out of existence as though they were little potholes filled with water, swelling ever higher and overtopping mountains and burying them deep beneath molten stone, boiling and bubbling, thousands of feet thick, billions of tons heavy. In 1889, on the occasion of the boring of an artesian well at Nampa, Idaho, on the Columbia Plateau near the Snake River, a small figurine of baked clay was extracted from a depth of 320 feet, penetrated after piercing a sheet of basalt lava 15 feet thick. G. F. Wright described the find and wrote, "The well was tubed with heavy iron tubing 6 inches in diameter, so that there could be no mistake about the occurrence of the image at the depth stated." He also added, "No one has come forward to challenge the evidence except on purely a priori grounds arising from preconceived opinions of the extreme antiquity of the deposits. Before the last lava sheets spread over the Columbia Plateau, there were human abodes in the area. A continent torn apart. Africa was in tension and torn by north and south fractures, which, along with the sinking of a strip of the crust, formed the longest meridional land valley on Earth. From Lebanon and Syria, then, almost to the Cape there runs a deep and comparatively narrow valley, margined by almost vertical sides, and occupied by the sea, by salt steppes and old lake basins, and by a series of over 20 lakes, of which only one has an outlet to the sea. This is a condition of things absolutely unlike anything else on the surface of the earth." The author of these lines, J.W. Gregory, the famous explorer of the Great African Rift, adopted the view that a general common cause created the entire rift from its north to its south end. The rift begins in the valley of the Ons River in Syria, at Baalbek it goes over to the Litani River Valley, then to Lake Hulay in Palestine, along the Jordan River to the Sea of Galilee, called also Jays Eret or the Sea of Tiberias, which lies in a depression below the level of the Mediterranean from there to the Dead Sea, the deepest depression on earth, between the Judean and Moabite mountainous plateaus that were torn apart, then along the Araba Valley to the Gulf of Aqaba in the Red Sea and across the channel of this sea into Africa, thence for an enormous distance to the Sabi River in the Transvaal, branching, on the way, eastward to the Gulf of Aden and westward to Tanganyika and the Upper Nile, and the rift valleys of Lakes Maurice and Upemba in the central Congo, all the way from about 36 degrees north latitude in Syria to about 28 degrees south latitude in East Africa, in a sinuous line along a meridian for more than a third of the way from one pole to another. It was recognized that a horizontal force of one kind or another had been the cause of this rift valley. The simplest and earliest thought was that Africa had been pulled apart. However, another school of geologists questioned whether the rift could not have been produced under horizontal pressure, which forced the margins of the rift valley up and the valley strip down. After a long debate, the consensus restated the view expressed by Edward Suess, a prominent geologist at the turn of the century, The opening of fissures of such magnitude can be explained only by the action of a tension, directed perpendicularly to the trend of the split. The tension being relieved in the instant of bursting, that is, of opening of the fissure. He observed also that immense floods of lava gushed out of the earth along the rift and a most vigorous volcanic action took place. Suess brought to geology the now generally accepted concept of Gondwanaland, a continental mass that occupied the larger portion of the Indian Ocean, and that in a relatively recent subsidence was torn apart and drowned. The subsidence at the Gondwana continent could have caused a strain on Western Asia and Africa, and under this tension the land must have been rent and the great rift formed. Krenkel, a German authority. Wart in Die Brüche, so known as Star Frickers, 1922, the tectonic setting of the fast African fault zones, whether considered in detail or as a whole, admits of only one explanation: they are zones of tearing apart of the sust, produced by a direct tension. The action of compressive forces is nowhere recognizable. Gregory wrote, the nearest approach in size to the rift can probably be found on the moon, whose clefts or hills no doubt represent long, steeply walled valleys and present to us much the same aspects as this East African valley would do to any inhabitants of our satellite. Not the least interesting of the points raised by the African, Red Sea, Jordan depression is the possibility that it may explain the nature of those lunar clefts which have so long been a puzzle to astronomers. The rift was produced by tension, hence the rifts on the moon were also caused by tension. Gregory followed Suess in linking the Great Rift Valley with the mountain chains due to the last great uplift of fold mountains in Europe, Asia, and the Americas. Thus the time of the last uplift, if established, would also clarify the time when Africa suffered the Great Rift. It is probable, too, that the rift began in one great tension and increased in the next. Gregory concluded, this wide, spread valley system is obviously not the result of some local fracture. Its length is about 1/6 of the circumference of the Earth. It must have some worldwide cause, the first promising clue to which is the date of its formation. Although Gregory thought that the rift first came into being at an early epoch, because of marine fossils found in it, he also saw signs of great earth movements along the rift at a recent date. Some of the fault scarps are so bare and sharp that they must be of very recent date. This continuation of earth movements into the human period is one of the most striking features of the district. Gregory found also that human memory retained recollection of the upheaval. All along the line the natives have traditions of great changes in the structure of the country. The globe was in tension and its crust cracked along a meridian for most of the length of the African continent. The cause may have been the subsidence of the Indian Ocean, or both tension in Africa and subsidence in the Indian Ocean could have a common cause. The mountain ridge on the floor of the Atlantic Ocean may have been produced by the same cause, and the time of the rupture and faulting must have been coincident with one of the periods of mountain formation in Europe and Asia. Those mountains attained their present height in the age of man. The rift, it is assumed today, was also created largely in the age of man at the end of the Ice Age. What kind of force is necessary to tear apart a continent? Whence came the tension that was relieved by the bursting of the African land mass? Ice did not do it, nor the wind that erodes mountain heights, nor the rivulets that carry eroded detritus down to the sea. Chapter 7, Deserts and Oceans. The Sahara. The Sahara Desert, which stretches from the Nile to the Atlantic Ocean across the continent of Africa and covers 3,500,000 square miles, about the area of all of Europe, is the greatest desert on Earth. What is now the desert of Sahara was an open grassland or steppe in earlier days. Drawings on rock of herds of cattle, made by early dwellers in this region, were discovered by Barth in 1850. Since then many more drawings have been found. The animals depicted no longer inhabit these regions, and many are generally extinct. It is asserted that the Sahara once had a large human population that lived in vast green forests and on fat pasture lands. Neolithic implements, vessels and weapons made of polished stone, were found close to the drawings. Such drawings and implements were discovered in the eastern as well as the western Sahara. Men lived in these densely populated flint regions and cattle pastured, where today enormous expanses of sand stretch for thousands of miles. Several theories have been offered to explain the prodigious quantity of sand in the Sahara. The theory of marine origin is now no longer tenable. The sand, it was found, is of recent origin. It is assumed that when a large part of Europe was under ice, the Sahara was in a warm and moist temperate zone. Later the soil lost its moisture and the rock crumbled to sand when left to the mercy of the sun and the wind. No long ago was it that conditions in the Sahara were suitable for human occupation. Movers, the noted orientalist of the last century, author of a large work on the Phoenicians, decided that the drawings in the Sahara were the work of the Phoenicians. It was likewise observed that on the drawings discovered by Bath the cattle wore discs between their horns, just as in Egyptian drawings. Also, the Egyptian god Set was found pictured on the rocks, and there are rock paintings of war chariots drawn by horses in an area where these animals could not survive 2 days without extraordinary precautions. The extinct animals in the drawings suggest that these pictures were made sometime during the Ice Age, but the Egyptian motifs in the very same drawings suggest that they were made in historical times. The conflict between the historical and the paleontological evidence, and of both of them with the geological evidence, is resolved if one or more catastrophes intervened. It appears that a large part of the region was occupied by an inland lake, or vast marsh, known to the ancients as Lake Triton. In a stupendous catastrophe, the lake emptied itself into the Atlantic, and the sand on its bottom and shores was left behind, forming a desert when tectonic movements sealed off the springs that fed the lake. The land of pastures and forests became a desert of sand, hippopotami that live in water and elephants disappeared, and with them also the hunter and the farmer. The French servant A. Berthelot says, "It is possible that Stone Age man witnessed in Africa three notable events, the sinking of the Spanish Atlas chain that opened the Strait of Gibraltar and created a junction between the Mediterranean Sea and the ocean, the collapse that cut off the Canary Islands from the African continent, the opening of the Strait of Bab el Mandeb, separating Arabia from Ethiopia." Berthelot, however, ascribed these great tectonic changes to the time of prehistoric man, and Abbé Broil actually showed that prehistoric man already occupied these regions, as the eolithic or very crudely chipped stone artifacts indicate. But at a later date, people of advanced culture, contemporary with pharaonic Egypt, lived in communities, pastured their cattle, and left their tools and drawings there. Then in an upheaval, of which many traditions persist in classical literature, the Atlas Mountains were torn apart, the Great Lake was emptied, and the watery region became the great and awesome desert, the Sahara. Arabia. There is a certainty beyond challenge that when the ice cap of the last glacial period covered a large part of the northern hemisphere, at least three great rivers flowed from west to east across the whole width of the Arabian Peninsula. So wrote Philby in his book Arabia. There was also a large lake in Arabia that disappeared in some geological or climatic change. At present, from Palmyra to Mecca and beyond, the Arabian Peninsula is a waterless desert, interspersed with volcanoes active not so long ago, but now extinct, the last eruption having taken place in 1253. There were also, sometime in the past, numerous geysers, all likewise extinct now. 20. Eight fields of burned and broken stones, called Haras, are found in Arabia, mostly in the western half of the Great Desert. Some single fields are 100 miles in diameter and occupy an area of 6,000 or 7,000 square miles, stone lying close to stone, so densely packed that passage through the fields is almost impossible. For the stones are sharp, edged and scorched black. No volcanic eruption could have cast scorched stones over fields as large as the Haras, neither would the stones from volcanoes have been so evenly spread. The absence, in most cases, of lava, the stones lie free, also speaks against a volcanic origin of the stones. It appears that the blackened and broken stones of the Haras are trains of meteorites, scorched in their passage through the atmosphere that broke during their fall, as bolides do or on reaching the ground. billions of stones in a single hara indicate that the trains of meteorites were very large and can be classed as comets. Despite alternate exposure to the thermal action of the hot desert sun and the cool desert night, the sharp edges of the stones have been preserved, which shows that they fell in a not too distant period of time. Following the procedure adopted in this book, literary references to the haras of Arabia in ancient Hebrew and Arabic literatures will not be dealt with here. Meteorites that fall on the earth are of two kinds. One consists of iron with an admixture of nickel. By means of this admixture and the characteristic pattern seen in the cut surface of such stones, their meteoric origin can be easily established. The other group, probably larger than the first, does not differ in its composition from the rocks of the earth and cannot be distinguished unless the fall has been observed, or, as in the case of the stones of the haras, their scorched and broken condition, together with their occurrence in large fields, speak for their extraterrestrial origin. Larger bodies than the stones of the haras fell on Arabia, too. In Wuhan in the desert there is a meteoric crater with meteoric iron and silica glass spread around it. Large rivers that disappeared, numerous volcanoes that burned and were extinguished, blackened stones that fell in areas each of them 100 times larger than any volcanic eruption could have covered, and meteoric iron spread around a large crater. All of these bespeak great upheavals in nature in recent as well as earlier ages, to which the vast peninsula of Arabia was more than once subjected. In the southern part of the Great Arabian Desert, ancient ruins, almost entirely obliterated by time and the elements, and vestiges of cultivation are silent witnesses of the time when the land there was hospitable and fruitful. It was as copiously watered and luxuriously forested as India on the same latitude. Orchards covered Hadramaut and Aden. It was a land of plenty, paradise on earth, but following a sudden catastrophe, Arabia Felix turned to a barren land. Arabia Petra, the western part of the desert, is a dusty rock of lava that is broken by the Great Rift, with the Dead Sea, an inner lake, on its bottom. Sulfurous springs flow into it, and asphalt rises from its floor and floats on it. Like the Sahara and Arabian deserts, other great deserts of the world disclose the fact that they were inhabited and cultivated sometime in the past. On the Tibetan Plateau and in the Gobi Desert, remains of early prosperous civilizations were found, with occasional ruins surviving from those times when the great barren tracts were cultivated. In the Gobi Desert, as in the Arabian and Sahara deserts, the impression is gained that in a tectonic disturbance the subterranean water dropped to a great depth, the sources became sealed, and the rivers dried up completely. Some changes in ground structure or in ground currents also affect the clouds, which pass over such lands without unburdening themselves. The Carolina Bays. Peculiar elliptical depressions, or oval craters, locally called bays, are thickly scattered over the Carolina coast of the United States and more sparsely over the entire Atlantic coastal plain from southern New Jersey to northeastern Florida. These marshy depressions are numbered in the tens of thousands and, according to the latest estimate, their number may reach 500,000. Measurements made on more prominent ones, seaward from Darlington, show that the larger bays average 2,200 feet in length, and in single cases exceed 8,000 feet. A remarkable feature of these depressions is their parallelism. The long axis of each of them extends from northwest to southeast, and the precision of the parallelism is striking. Around the bays are rims of earth, invariably elevated at the southeastern end. These oval depressions may be seen especially well in aerial photographs. Any theory as to their origin must explain their form, the ellipticity of which increases with the size of the bays, their parallel alignment, and the elevated runs at their southeastern ends. In 1933, a theory was presented by Melton and Shriver of the University of Oklahoma, according to which the bays are scars left by a meteoric shower or colliding comet. Since then, the majority of the authors who have dealt with the problem have accepted this view, and it has found its way into textbooks as the usual interpretation. 8. The authors of the theory stress the fact that, since the origin of the bays apparently cannot be explained by the well-known types of geological activity, an extraordinary process must be found. Such a process is suggested by the elliptical shape, the parallel alignment, and the systematic arrangement of elevated rims. The comet must have struck from the northwest. If the cosmic masses approached this region from the northwest, the major axes would have the desired alignment. The time when the catastrophe took place was estimated as sometime during the Ice Age. The bays are filled to a considerable extent by the deposition of sand and silt, a process which doubtless occurred while the region was covered by the sea during the Terrace, forming marine invasion of the Pleistocene, glacial, period. But the possibility was also envisaged that the collision took place through the shallow ocean water during the marine invasion. The swarm of meteorites must have been large enough to hit an area from Florida to New Jersey. Some critics disagree with the idea that the bays originated in the Ice Age or are relatively ancient, and place their origin in a more recent time. The craters were produced by meteoric impact, either by direct hits or by explosion in the air close to the ground, thus causing the formation of vast numbers of depressions. Some of the bays, it is assumed, are on the bottom of the ocean. It was also stressed that a very large number of meteorites have been discovered in the southern Appalachian region, in Virginia, North and South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Kentucky, and Tennessee. The bottom of the Atlantic. In the fall of 1949, Professor M. Ewing of Columbia University published a report on an expedition to the Atlantic Ocean. Explorations were carried on especially in the region about the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, the mountainous chain that runs from north to south, following the general outlines of the ocean. The ridge, as well as the ocean bottom to the west and to the east, disclosed to the expedition a series of facts that amounts to new scientific puzzles. One was the discovery of prehistoric beach sand, brought up in one case from a depth of 2 and the other nearly 3.5 miles, far from any place where beaches exist today. One of these sand deposits was found 1,200 miles from land. Sand is produced from rocks by the eroding action of sea waves pounding the coast, and by the action of rain and wind and the alternation of heat and cold. On the bottom of the ocean the temperature is constant, there are no currents, it is a region of motionless stillness. Mid-ocean bottoms are covered with ooze made up of silt so fine that its particles can be carried suspended in ocean water for a long time before they sink to the bottom, there to build sediment. The ooze contains skeletons of the minnow animals, foraminifera that live in the upper waters of the ocean in vast numbers. But there should be no coarse sand on the mid-ocean floor, because sand is native to land areas and to the continental shelf, the coastal rim of the ocean and its seas. These considerations presented Professor Ewing with a dilemma: either the land must have sunk 2 or 3 miles, or the sea once must have been 2 or 3 miles lower than now. Either conclusion is startling. If the sea was once 2 miles lower, where could all the extra water have gone? It is regarded as an accepted truth in geology that the seas have not changed their beds with the exception of encroachment by shallow water on depressed continental areas. Thus it was difficult to accept the startling conclusion that the bottom of the ocean was at some time in the past dry land, but there was another surprise in store for the expedition. The thickness of the sediment on the ocean bottom was measured by the well-developed method of sound echoes. An explosion is set off and the time it takes for the echo to return from the sediment on the floor of the ocean is compared with the time required for a second echo to return from the bottom of the sediment, or from the bedrock, basalt or granite. These measurements clearly indicate thousands of feet of sediments on the foothills of the ridge. Surprisingly, however, we have found that in the great flat basins, on either side of the ridge, this sediment appears to be less than 100 feet thick, a fact so startling actually. The echoes arrived almost simultaneously, and the most that could be attributed in such circumstances to the sediment was less than 100 feet of thickness, or the margin of error. Always it had been thought the sediment must be extremely thick, since it had been accumulating for countless ages. But on the level basins that flank the mid-Atlantic ridge our signals reflected from the bottom mud and from bedrock came back too close together to measure the time between them. They show the sediment in the basins is less than 100 feet thick. The absence of thick sediment on the level floor presents another of many scientific riddles our expedition propounded. It indicates that the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean on both sides of the ridge was only very recently formed. At the same time, on the flanks of the ridge the layers of sediment in some places are thousands of feet thick, as was expected. These ocean bottom sediments we measured are formed from the shells and skeletons of countless small sea creatures and from volcanic dust and wind-blown soil drifting out over the sea, and from the ashes of burned-out meteorites and cosmic dust from outer space sifting constantly down upon the Earth. Burned-out meteorites and cosmic dust elicited the question, if the meteoric dust in our age is so sparse that it is hardly detectable on the snow of high mountains, how could ashes of burned-out meteorites and cosmic dust make up a substantial part of the oceanic sediment? And how could it be that all other sources, including detritus earned by rivers, have created in all ages since the beginning a sediment of only very moderate thickness? We dredged up rocks of igneous, or fire-made, type from the sides and tops of peaks on the mid-Atlantic ridge, which indicated that submarine volcanoes and lava flows have been active there. Probably the whole ridge is highly volcanic, with perhaps thousands of lava outpourings and active and extinct cones scattered along its entire length. And not only the submarine ridge is volcanic. There are many peaks of volcanic origin scattered over the Atlantic basin. In the direction of the Azores, the expedition found an uncharted submarine mountain, 8,000 feet high, with many layers of volcanic ash, and farther on, a great hole dropping down 1,809 fathoms, 10,854 feet, as if a volcano had caved in there at some time in the past. Lava flowed under the water of the ocean, and the water must have boiled, meteorites, ashes, and cosmic dust fell from the sky, land was submerged thousands of fathoms deep, and beaches sank over 3 miles into the depths. From the abyss of the ocean, rocks marked with deep scratches were raised by the expedition. In a depth of 3,600 feet, 600 fathoms, we found rocks that tell an interesting story about the past history of the Atlantic Ocean, granite and sedimentary rocks of types which originally must have been part of a continent. Most of the rocks that we dredged here were rounded and marked with deep scratches, or striations. Such marks on rocks are regularly ascribed to the action of glaciers that held rocks in a firm grip and moved them over the surface of other rocks. But we also found some loosely consolidated mudstones, so soft and weak they would not have held together in the iron grasp of a glacier. How they got out here is another riddle to be solved by further research. Finally, the very entrance to New York Harbor, the Hudson River, was found to have a canyon running into the ocean, not only for the width of the continental shelf, 120 miles offshore, as has been known for some time, but also for another 100 miles in deeper water. If all this valley was originally carved out by the river on dry land, as seems probable, it means either that the ocean floor of the eastern seaboard of North America once must have stood about 2 miles above its present level and has since subsided, or else that the level of the sea was once about 2 miles lower than now. Each one of these possibilities indicates an upheaval. All in all, the results of the expedition of the summer of 1949 strongly indicate that, at some time not so long ago, in numerous places where the Atlantic Ocean is today there were land and beaches, and that in revolutions on a great scale land became sea thousands of fathoms deep. The leader of the Atlantis expedition, whom we have quoted here, did not use the term revolution, but it is unavoidable in the face of the expedition's finds. In order not to be regarded as the proponent of a heresy, Ewing made only a negative statement. There is no reason to believe that this mighty underwater mass of mountains is connected in any way with the legendary loss to Atlantis which Plato described as having sunk beneath the waves. The floor of the seas. In July 1947, a Swedish deep sea expedition left Göteborg on the Albatross for a 15-month journey around the world to investigate the bottom of the seas on the 17,000 miles of the ship's course with the help of a newly constructed vacuum core sampler. In the sediment that covers the rocky bottom of the oceans, the expedition found, in the words of its leader, H. Pettersen, director of the Oceanographic Institute at Göteborg, evidence of great catastrophes that have altered the face of the Earth.